Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Brendan Loy, attorney registration 39611, appearing on behalf of Eric Halila. Law enforcement officers in this case egregiously violated Mr. Halila's Fourth Amendment rights in a manner that should shock the conscience of this court. Officers investigating an alleged reckless driving infraction forced their way into this man's home without a warrant. They later sought to justify this warrantless entry by citing an exigent circumstance, the emergency aid exception of the Fourth Amendment, namely Mr. Halila's health. But their concern for Mr. Halila's health was speculative at best and, according to the record, quite likely pretextual, as it is belied by the undisputed facts. The officers did not call an ambulance or paramedics to the scene. They did not ask before entering the room if Mr. Halila needed medical help. They did not ask after entering the room if Mr. Halila needed medical help. In fact, when Mr. Halila sat up and asked, "Why are you in my house?" the officers didn't respond because we wanted to check on you. Are you all right? Do you need any medical assistance? They simply said, "Get up and get dressed." They then proceeded to begin interrogating him about the driving incident that they were investigating and about possible alcohol consumption, and proceeded to begin collecting evidence to make an arrest. Their actions strongly suggest that the alleged emergency aid rationale for their entry, their warrantless entry into his home, was simply a pretext. Moreover, the officers admit that they didn't know if Mr. Halila had a health problem before entering into his home. This cannot support the good faith belief in an immediate, in a probable immediate crisis inside the home, which is what is required by numerous cases, both in Colorado and federal courts, as the basis for an emergency aid exigent circumstance. The lack of knowledge does not satisfy that burden. Exceptions to the Fourth Amendment must be strictly circumscribed, as the countless cases have stated. And here, the officers simply decided to make a warrantless entry first, sort out the legalities later. That's what the undisputed facts indicate. So a few undisputed facts to keep in mind in this case. When the police arrived at the room, they suspected, but did not know, that the man in room 120 was the driver of the vehicle they were investigating. They also did not have evidence, as the hearing officer found, of intoxication until after they'd already entered the room. So that doesn't even enter into the analysis. They were simply investigating a reckless driving case. It's also important to keep in mind this was not a vehicular stop. Even though it involved a car, the officers were entering into this person's home. And it's been established by multiple cases in Colorado that a hotel room is accorded Fourth Amendment protection. This was this person's home, and in fact, Mr. Halila himself said that when he said, "Why are you in my house?" The facts of what occurred are important. The officers arrived on the scene. They knocked on the door of the room that contained the man who they believed potentially to be Mr. Halila. He responded, believing that it was maid service, he said, "It's open." The officer then knocked again. He again said, "It's open." They knocked a third time, and this time they identified themselves as police officers. And at that time, Mr. Halila did not respond, and he did not respond in the several minutes after that once they were identified as police officers. The officers, according to their account, took that, non-responsiveness once they identified themselves as police as being a evidence of a medical crisis. But of course, Mr. Halila was simply exercising his constitutional right to remain silent in response to an inquiry from a police officer. And the exercise of one's Miranda rights is not a medical crisis.
Mr. Loy, I'm sorry. I was having a tough time getting a word in.
I apologize. That's fine.
You're very fast. This case resembles the Hansen case a lot. I think that at some level you would at least agree with that, although I suspect you'll have ways to distinguish it. But in the Hansen case, they were also faced with the same two arguments that I hear you making, and that is that the actions shocked the conscience and were done in bad faith, and the Supreme Court rejected both of those. Could you address that,
please? Yes, Your Honor. The Hansen case, there was, as you know from reading our briefs, some of our arguments that we made in our opening brief were wiped out by the Hansen case, as we acknowledged in our reply brief. However, we believe the Hansen case actually strengthens the argument that we presented in our reply brief that I'm presenting to you now about the outrageous the outrageousness of the conduct, because Hansen, even in any context of a case involving a reckless driving that potentially involves driving under the influence, reaffirmed the fact that there is this exception that exists for exceptionally severe and egregious misconduct by the officers. And as you say, there are some similarities between the facts. I don't deny that at all, but there are also significant differences. In Hansen, it was a warrantless entry into a home, but in that case, there was severe, the opinion indicated there was severe damage to the car that the officers looked at before going into the home. Here, Mr. Halilla's car had only minor damage. The mirror was broken, and there was a damage to, I believe, the bumper, but it wasn't the sort of damage that would suggest a potential serious injury to the driver in the car as being a likely scenario. There was also damage to the garage window at the defendant's home. The officer knew from witness statements the driver had been going over 100 miles per hour, which in and of itself gives rise to a higher potential for significant injury. And also with respect to the outrageousness factor, Hansen involved a front door of the residence that was open, and an officer walked into to that open door. Now, it does not necessarily mean there wasn't a constitutional violation. Obviously, you can violate the Constitution and Fourth Amendment rights by walking through an open door. But when we're talking about egregiousness and bad faith and outrageousness, I do think that going to a car after several minutes, getting bolt cutters and cutting the bolt of a locked door does give rise to a certain additional level of concern. In addition, I would point out that at the time the Hansen case was decided, the statutory issues and the overall question of whether the exclusionary rule applied in general to these sorts of cases was unsettled. And although, as you point out, the briefing did raise the argument that we're raising here and the court rejected it for the factual reasons I think I just articulated, it's also true that it wasn't emphasized as strongly as it is here because they were relying on primarily on the two sort of overarching arguments. And the court didn't spend very much time analyzing the egregiousness issue because it just wasn't both the facts of the support and it just wasn't as central to the arguments that were being made. And I also think one last critical difference in Hansen, they called an ambulance. An ambulance came to the scene. In fact, the gentleman was taken to the hospital. Whereas here, very critically, as I said, the police officers did not take any of the steps that you would take if you were concerned about someone's health. They didn't even ask him how he was doing in terms of his health. And so that, to me, suggests, and I believe legally suggests, a pretextual argument here that was not present in the Hansen case.
But they had put the fire truck or EMTs on standby, correct?
Yes, the officers, some testimony was that they had placed some sort of paramedics on standby. I'm not exactly sure what that means. I kind of feel like they're always on standby, but yes, the testimony does indicate they were placed on standby, and then later they were told after the officers had ascertained that Mr. Halilla was okay, I guess they waved them off. I don't understand that because they didn't ascertain that he was okay. They didn't ask him how he was doing. They didn't do any sort of checks on that. They just immediately went into investigation and arrest mode. The officer's own testimony reflects that. So I understand that that is in the record, but I'm not sure how probative and just how relevant it is to legal issues there and the application of law that we're dealing with.
And you filed some supplemental authority, and I don't want to prevent you from being able to make your argument. Are you going to address some of that during your argument? I have a question.
Okay. At this point, I don't think so, unless maybe in rebuttal in terms of the supplemental authority. I just want to ask your question.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because, as you stated, when you wrote your brief, you didn't have the ultimate decision in Hansen, which addressed much of your original argument. And so the egregiousness really seems to be kind of the issue that we're dealing with today. And it seemed from reading the supplemental authority, for instance, with Maldonado, they talk about how stringent the standard is, and it's a shock to the conscience, and it's really satisfied. And the case of the supplemental authority that seems to be most helpful to you, in my estimation, is the Kotsujay case. But it seems as though in that case, the circumstances of the person who was actually subject to that case was very distinct from this factual situation because the Kotsuge was not the person who they were ultimately trying to apprehend when they went to that location. He ultimately ended up getting caught up in this whole broader sweep, I guess would be an appropriate word. So how do you apply or suggest we're able to apply Kotsuge to the factual situation here given those significant differences?
I think that the facts are quite different. I think that the reason why we included Kotsuge and the other cases was more sort of reiterating the general rule and also the fact that these determinations are made on a case-by-case basis, not so much that we were suggesting the facts are directly on point. I think that one, perhaps more on point than Kotsuge and more helpful, I think, to the court in determining how do you ascertain whether exigent circumstances exist, is to look at the People v. Hermes case, which we cited like, in our opening brief, if I recall correctly, where it lists six factors for determining whether exigent circumstances exist. And here, I think we would argue that none of them exist. And that, to me, would seem to suggest a sort of egregious violation that we're talking about. The factors, whether a greater offense was involved, particularly a crime of violence, here we're talking about a misdemeanor or reckless driving issue that the police were investigating. Whether the suspect is reasonably believed to be armed, there's no evidence or suggestion of that here. Whether there exists a clear showing or probable cause to believe that the suspect committed the crime prior to the entry into the room, they didn't have that. Whether there's strong reason to believe the suspect is in the premises being entered, I think there was some reason to suspect that he was. They were connecting certain dots, but I don't believe it's fair to characterize it as a strong reason to believe. That's why they went in and got identification and confirmed that. The likelihood that the suspect will escape if not swiftly apprehended, there was no such likelihood, there was no such possibility. The police had both the door and the window covered. And lastly, whether the entry is made peaceably. Here, they used a bolt cutter to there wasn't, again, walking in an open door, I used a bolt cutter to break down the door. And so I think that those six factors, none of which are met in this case, may be the best guide to suggesting and showing that this was not just a garden variety constitutional violation, but an egregious one. And that for that reason, the exclusionary rule should be applied as it was stated in the Hansen case. I'm going to reserve the remaining of my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Grant Sullivan of the Colorado Attorney General's Office, registration number 40151. With me is Senior Assistant Attorney General Kerry Williams. We represent the Department of Revenue. The sole issue presented by this case, as stated in the reply brief, is whether or not the so-called bad faith exception should be applied to this case. That is, whether or not the exclusionary rule, despite its general inapplicability in DMV licensing hearings, should be applied to this case because the law enforcement officer's conduct was so flagrant, so outrageous, that it rose to the level of bad faith or shocking the conscience. The department believes that the conduct here simply does not meet that high threshold, and that's for two reasons. First, the contact here is valid, but even if it were a close question, the fact that it is a close issue places it well below that threshold needed for bad faith or shocking the conscience. And second, this case is factually indistinguishable from the recent Hansen decision handed down by the Colorado Supreme Court. In light of your question, Judge Romano, I want to skip ahead to that particular issue, the factual circumstances of the Hansen case, which is, of course, is a case Judge Terry is familiar with, having sat on the panel when it was in this court. But in both, in the Supreme Court and in this court, the court declined to apply the exclusionary rule. They declined to find either bad faith or conduct that shocks the conscience. And the facts were remarkably similar. In Hansen, the driver struck a highway sign and continued driving. The driver was weaving through traffic and was speeding at excessive speeds. Impartial citizens followed the driver in the Hansen case and made reports to the police, just as in this case. The driver made it to his residence in the Hansen case, and officers observed a vehicle outside the residence that appeared damaged, the same as in this case. Officers called for an ambulance in the Hansen case, that's true, because the driver's condition was unknown. Here, the officer placed the fire department on standby. The officer in Hansen knocked on the door and made announcements, and there were no announcements, no responses to the announcements at the front door. In both cases, the officer then entered the front door, found the driver, and noticed the same indicia of intoxication. Bloodshot eyes, unsteady balance, slurred speech, odor of alcohol. And both drivers in Hansen and this case refused chemical testing. So I think the Hansen case does offer significant legal authority for finding that the conduct here simply does not rise to the high threshold needed for bad faith or conduct that shocks the conscience. In fact, the only distinguishing facts about Hansen actually militate against applying the exclusionary rule, because the facts in Hansen arguably were worse than the facts here. In Hansen, the officer never observed the driver prior to breaching the front door, whereas here, the officers viewed the driver through the hotel window, saw that he was naked and passed out on the bed, and he was non-responsive to knocks and announcements. That led the officers to be concerned for the welfare of that person inside the hotel room. That fact is absent in Hansen. He had never seen the driver, and yet the Supreme Court still found lack of bad faith, lack of conduct that shocked the conscience.
Well, just prior to that, though, they had knocked, and he had said to come in.
In this case,
correct. Apparently they tried, couldn't get in, knocked a second time, come in. And then still couldn't get in, so then they identified themselves, and then he went silent. So that's different, too, than the Hansen case, isn't it?
It is slightly different. I think the similarity is that in Hansen, they knocked, and there was no response. So the third knock would be similar here. They argue that this is an exercise of his Fifth Amendment rights. I think a better exercise of that might have been, come back with a warrant, I'm just fine. But the fact that there was silence after the third knock could have suggested reasonably to a reasonable officer that, well, we know someone's in there, and now they're not responding. We can see them through the window. They're unresponsive, naked, passed out on the bed at 5 in the afternoon. Maybe there is something wrong with them. Maybe there is alcohol poisoning. Maybe there is a closed head injury that we need to act on.
Yeah, but I wonder how many of our citizens would know to say, come back with a warrant, I'm just fine.
But again, the silence...
Or perhaps go away.
Or go away, sure. I mean, those are all reasonable responses that he could have made, but he didn't. The fact that there was silence, I think, gave the officers concerns, just as there was silence in the after the Hansen knock in Hansen. So again, but these are very, very nuanced differences that I don't think can be the basis for finding egregiousness or bad faith. I mean, I think the worst facts in Hansen, as I just described, the fact that he went in not having even observed the driver in Hansen, and yet the Supreme Court still found a lack of bad faith. There's a few other facts in Hansen that I think arguably placed Hansen in a worse category. In Hansen, the record showed that the police officer had been the subject of an internal affairs investigation and ultimately resigned from the police force. That fact is not present here. And in Hansen, there was a suppression order entered in the parallel criminal case. That fact is also not present in this record. So I think that there are slight differences between the Hansen case, but they place Hansen at a worse category, and yet the Supreme Court still declined to find bad faith.
Can I ask another factual question, since you're talking about the facts, which I don't know that any of us have the answer to, but since they had gone to get the key, and then they got the master key, and then they realized they still couldn't get in, because there was some kind of bolt or chain. Mm-hmm. The next step of taking the bolt cutter seems to be ratcheting it up quite a bit, wasn't it? And from reviewing the record, it doesn't appear as though there's anything to indicate after they got the chain part open, and I assume it had some opening then to the door, they didn't, for instance, yell in there or try and get any further response at that point.
But I don't think the record speaks to that, Your Honor. I think the record simply says that from the time that they observed the individual through the window, passed out, unresponsive to announcements, From that point to the time that they were able to make entry, so getting the bolt cutters, making the cut, and again, I think it was a small chain, not a large hinge, because it was just a click, is what the record reflects. That was a 5-minute period, and there was no response from the individual in the hotel room during that time. So I think the fact that there was this action going on at the door, at the motel room, and no response from the individual inside gave them even graver concern about the welfare of that person. I think if the person were conscious and alert, they would have been able to respond at that point when they opened it, just that crack, to see that there's individuals there that are trying to get in. But yet he didn't do that. He remained on the bed, not alert, until they actually did make entry. I want to return to the first argument I was planning to make prior to addressing Hansen. Again, the department fully contends that this is a valid contact under the emergency aid exception. But even if the constitutionality of the contact were a close question, that does not automatically mean that this conduct is in bad faith or that it shocks the conscience. I think what's interesting about the reply brief in this case is that it acknowledges that this very high standard applies, but then it seeks to relitigate the constitutionality of the contact. That is the wrong question in this case. The question is not, is this a good contact or a bad contact? It's, is this conduct so flagrant, so outrageous, that it can be said that it shocks the conscience? Officers, in the heat of the moment, make split-second decisions every day, and they do sometimes make mistakes. Sometimes these mistakes are instances of isolated negligence. We expect those sometimes, and we deter that conduct by applying the exclusionary rule in the criminal trial. But it's the rare case, the highly unusual case, where the conduct is so flagrant and so outrageous that we take that extra step of applying the exclusionary rule in the civil licensing hearing. It's conduct that the U.S. Supreme Court has described as intended to injure in some way, unjustified by any governmental interest. And the examples that you see in the case law are things like police brutality, forced medical procedures, a knowing pretextual arrest of someone on probation because they're on probation, they must be doing something bad, a course of police harassment over the course of several encounters. These sorts of instances are what we think of when we think of shocking the conscience, and it's just not present in this case. What the police officers, the information they had in front of them, I think shows that they did have a sincere, good faith belief that the person in that hotel room might have been in need of medical attention. They had the witnesses' statements that this homer had sideswiped another vehicle, had struck 3 different directional posts, and in Hansen, by the way, they had hit 1 directional post, not 3. And they had the witnesses' statements that this SUV, this Hummer, H2, had collided with the concrete wall while entering I-25 on-ramp. The officers observed this damage to the Hummer in the hotel parking lot, and again, upon knocking, on the third knock, they heard silence. And again, observing through the window, a man passed out, naked on the bed, unresponsive, that caused sufficient concern for them that they put the fire department on standby. I think viewed as a whole, the totality of these circumstances can dispel any notion that these officers acted in bad faith. If the court has no further questions.
Well, all the things that you just said, the hearing officers so found, I take it, right?
The hearing officer did make fairly detailed factual findings. They're in the record. I don't think he went through everything I just did, but everything I went through is in the record in the officer's reports. The hearing officer credited those reports and did. I think these findings are pretty extensive, actually, compared to some of the hearing officer findings that you do see.
Thank you.
We'd ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you.
Your Honors, my learned colleague suggests that Mr. Halilla should have engaged in a better exercise of the Fifth Amendment by saying, I'm just fine, come back with a warrant. We would suggest that the police should have engaged in a better inquiry into his health by by, for instance, asking through the door, "Are you all right, sir? Do you need help?" Perhaps he would have responded, "No, I'm fine, please go away." Perhaps he wouldn't. We'll never know because they didn't make that inquiry. Instead, they proceeded straight to the path of breaking down his door, trying to enter with a key card and breaking down his door with a bolt cutter. That is egregious conduct for the reasons that we've laid out in our brief. As far as the notion of a closed head injury, there was no inquiry into the possibility of a closed head injury. The fact that he stood up from the bed doesn't mean he didn't have a closed head injury. If they were concerned about that, they would have taken different steps. This case is not factually indistinguishable from Hansen because the pretext issue did not exist in Hansen. There was no sign of it here. In that case, there is a sign of it here. There was an allusion to the Resson case. It wasn't mentioned by name, but the Resson case dealing with pretext arrests. That is, a pretextual police action is the sort of thing that has been found to constitute egregious violations of the Fourth Amendment, and we believe that's what we have here. In terms of the notion that the police were acting in the heat of the moment, nobody disputes that police officers have a tough job to do, but the confidence in the system requires them to do it the right way and to not gain an advantage by egregiously doing it the wrong way. Here, they weren't acting in the heat of the moment. They had at least 5 minutes to deal with this situation. It was in the afternoon. They could have called, they could have tried to get a warrant if they felt that was necessary. It was not a hostage situation. Yes, sir.
Mr. Lloyd, let me just tell you what concerns me at this point. I hear your argument, okay? But unless I'm mistaken, the police officer indicated at the hearing that the arresting officer, that he acted because of exigent circumstances and described what those were. And then the hearing officer made a finding that it was exigent circumstances. The three of us did not get to judge the arresting officer's credibility in making that statement. So how could we substitute our judgment for the hearing officer's on that point at this time?
I'm almost out of time, Your Honor, but I think that what we're asking you to do is to apply the law to the undisputed facts, not to disturb factual findings. To the extent that there are factual findings embedded in that, we would argue that they are unsupported, clearly unsupported by the facts in the record. And I'm out of time, so we ask that you reverse the district court and order Mr. Lloyd's license to serve.
Thank you very much, both of you, for your arguments, and we will issue an opinion in due course.
I would just like to say it's very refreshing to have experienced counsel be supportive of somewhat less experienced counsel coming and arguing before the Court of Appeals. And I'd like to commend both counsel for your excellent work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.